From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Rafael, California.
I'm from San Jose.
Hayward, California.
Nopa.
Kind of lower Russian Hill.
I live across from El Matate in San Francisco.
Coming up, we'll hear how city planners are taking a cue from the past to bring Bay Area housing into the future.
The whole point is you live here, you work here, you can take the train to work, and it's amazing to watch in the morning people that are walking to the BART station here. It's quite phenomenal.
Then we'll learn the ins and outs of cap and trade while rolling a pair of dice.
You're a polluter. Everybody in the game is a polluter.
And what's the sound? Take a guess, we'll have the answer to this week's mystery sound from Audiograph. That's all coming up today on Cross Currents. If you're feeling nervous about next week's commute, you should be. BART workers could go on strike for the second time in 5 weeks if unions and management can't reach a deal by Sunday. Earlier this week, BART defied the gag order imposed by a state mediator and released both sides' positions to the public. The transit agency is offering the unions an 8% unconditional raise over 4 years. That's 4% higher than their pre-strike offer. BART also wants its employees to start contributing to their pensions and cover more of their health insurance. The unions want a 21.5% raise over 3 years and no added payments for health care. SEIU Local 1021 Executive Director Pete Castelli says even with BART's proposed raise, many people would lose take-home pay.
What they have on the table, and you know, I really hate to break the embargo myself, but BART is cornering us on this. It would basically take almost $2,000 over the life of the contract out of that worker's pocket.
BART and the unions have until Sunday to agree on a new contract. Like last time, the unions say they'll give 72 hours notice if they plan to strike. So if it's happening, we'll know tomorrow morning. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. If you're not sitting on a BART train right now, it's very likely that you're stuck in traffic. The Bay Area is one of the most congested places in the whole country, behind L.A. and Honolulu. And over the next 30 years, 2 million more people are expected to move here. To handle all that change, we're going to need a plan. And as of mid-July, we have one. Plan Bay Area, a long-term strategy to guide growth in the region. A fundamental part of it is the prediction that most of those 2 million new people are going to live and work in what are called transit-oriented developments, or TODs. These are planned neighborhoods with housing, offices, and retail space centered around a transit hub like BART or light rail. The point is to make cars optional for residents and workers.
In truth, it's not a new idea.
Robert Severo teaches urban planning at UC Berkeley. He says TODs are modeled after dense urban walkable cities like New York or Paris.
So in many ways, transit-oriented development takes the pre-automobile era streetcar cities of 100 years ago and tries to modernize it, really tries to adapt it to the 21st century.
Patsy Denny of Morgan Hill spoke during the public comment period before the plan was passed and compared Plan Bay Area to Cold War-era communist policies.
I would like to challenge all of you to get on an airplane and fly to Russia, China, and Siberia. I've been to all three, and if you don't understand what your housing is going to look like, go and look at it.
So do TODs, or stack and packs, as many opponents call them, really work? KALW's Isabel Angel visited two of them to find out.
Welcome to Fruitvale, Fruitvale Station. This is the Fruitvale Station. Thank you.
Back in the 1990s, BART wanted to build a big parking garage at its Fruitvale Station in East Oakland. But the garage would have cut the station off from the rest of this mostly immigrant, low-income neighborhood. So the community resisted, and the Unity Council, a nonprofit advocacy group for the neighborhood, brought up the idea of building a transit-oriented development instead.
And we made a deal with BART.
Jeff Pace is the chief operations officer for the Unity Council.
And the way I like to characterize the deal is, BART said that if you, the Unity Council, if you design something get community backing for it and their input. If you finance it, build it, own it, operate it, then we'll let you do that.
So, like, they would let you use this space and not turn it into a parking lot?
Correct.
The council built Fruitvale Village, a collection of apartments, offices, and retail space centered around the BART station. And as part of the deal, they also built BART their parking garage. But they stuck it off to the side, where it wouldn't interfere with the neighborhood. Fruitvale Village packs a lot into three blocks, and it's not just apartments and businesses. There's a large health clinic, a preschool, and a counseling center for foster kids. There's even a charter high school, Arise, right next to a senior center. Pace says at first, Fruitvale Village, which was completed in 2004, had a hard time filling up its retail spaces. But now, he says it's a big success.
We like to say we're 100, 100, 100. We've got 100% occupancy in all three of our main uses, the residential, the commercial, community service, and the retail.
Fruitvale Village has also made some headway on the main goal of transit-oriented development, getting people out of cars. A 2006 survey, which Pace admits is a long time ago, showed that over 30% of residents take BART to work. That's four times the average for the rest of Oakland.
So, I mean, if you put people really close to mass transit, they use it.
Next station, Pleasant Hill Station.
22 miles inland from Fruitvale Village on the Pittsburgh Bay Point BART line is the Contra Costa Center. It's right next to downtown Walnut Creek at the Pleasant Hill BART station. The neighborhood is quiet and spread out, about half a square mile of office parks, condos, and retail space. It's a big contrast from Fruitvale Village. The center, which was organized in 1985, attracts residents and businesses by offering a suburban setting that's walkable and close to public transit. It also offers perks to workers who don't drive. Property owners chip in to a general fund that pays for things like reduced-price BART tickets and cash for people who carpool. In all, 30% of people who work at the center don't drive there alone. The county's average is 20%. In fact, part of the center's program to get workers out of cars involves giving them access to cars.
Just drive down Oak for a minute, Chris, real quick. To the left.
Yeah, that's right.
Lynn Busby is the executive director of the Contra Costa Center. She and her colleague showed me around the development in one of their car share Nissan Leafs.
If you take BART or a bus to work or walk or ride your bike, we have a car sharing program that's free of charge to anyone. The building owners pay for that.
Busby says the cars let people drive to lunch and run errands, so they can leave their own cars at home. The center has also added a fleet of bikes and Segways people can check out for free. But even after almost two decades, Busby points out the Contra Costa Center isn't finished yet.
This block D is supposed to be a 12-story office building. It's this block that's fenced over here. That's the only vacant piece besides the other one over here, which is scheduled for 100 condos for sale units.
There's also still some empty retail along the bottom floor of two apartment buildings that were built in 2010. Busby says the space is slowly filling up, and she hopes a plan for a restaurant will go through.
The whole point is you live here, you work here, you can take the train to work, and it's amazing to watch in the morning people that are walking to the BART station here. It's quite phenomenal.
And this is exactly what the architects of Plan Bay Area want the future to look like. The plan estimates that over two-thirds of the region's new housing will be built on 5% of the land, mostly in TODs very similar to Fruitvale Village or the Contra Costa Center. But not everyone sees the future the same way. It's up to individual Bay Area cities to decide how they want to grow. For Cross Currents, I'm Isabel Angel.
Is your neighborhood growing or changing in any way? Let us know. Call our feedback line at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Plan Bay Area aims to improve the region's overall well-being. That includes environmental changes, like finding better ways to cut greenhouse gas emissions. California's cap-and-trade program sets limits on how much carbon polluters can emit, like smoke from a factory, for instance, and it allows them to trade what are called carbon offsets for the ability to pollute more. That trading happens in a marketplace, but just like any marketplace, it's not as simple as it sounds. There's a complicated system in place that measures pollution and determines when and how polluters can trade for carbon credits, all with precise calculations and not so easy to follow procedures. But the folks at the San Francisco Public Press have taken it upon themselves to break it all down and simplify what cap and trade means and how it really works. And what better way to simplify a complex system than turn it into a board game? Michael Stoll is executive director of the San Francisco Public Press, and Anna Vignier is a reporter and illustrator there. They both joined me in studio to play some California cap and trade.
The yellow pieces represent smokestacks. They are allowances for each space on the board to pollute. They represent the productivity of each spot.
Okay, and what do the paper clips represent on the board?
Yeah, these should be little plastic pieces that are that look like little light bulbs, and those represent R&D, innovation. We started out with the red smokestacks representing the ability to pollute that you could buy and sell.
So as you go around the board, you can land on something that says, hey, you can pollute. Here's some smokestacks.
And players can trade with each other.
And you are who? You're a polluter.
You're a polluter. Everybody in the game is a polluter. You can play up to 8 players. But every space on the board has to be owned by somebody. This is part of the idea of the trading system. You're just trading the ability to pollute, trading profits back and forth when you spend money and earn money on the products and services that you create. But there are also these other elements aside from the smokestacks, such as the innovation and such as the carbon offsets, which are represented by little plastic trees. And each of them works in subtly different ways. For example, the trees allow you to keep an extra smokestack every time you pass go. Normally what happens is that every time you pass go, you have to give up one of the smokestacks. That's the idea behind the cap. And you go around the board enough times, and essentially, if you're playing with the maximum 8 players, you go from 80 smokestacks down to 40. Hmm. That's the idea of cutting pollution by a huge margin.
Without going broke.
No money disappears from the board.
Okay, so I'm rolling the dice. Here we go.
That's 6 and 4.
Rolled a 10. And in doing so, I passed go. So that means that I lose 1 smokestack.
Okay, so you put this in the middle of the board and that disappears.
So you put your smokestack when you lose it in the middle of the board. Okay.
Yeah.
And then what did you land on and what does it say?
So I landed on a factory space. Every space on the board represents 1 facility in California. Hmm. I landed on a paper manufacturing facility, the Kimberly-Clark Worldwide facility, which is in Fullerton. And their 2011 emissions were 63,624 metric tons of carbon dioxide. I landed on Michael's space. This is his facility. Mm-hmm. So since I landed on it, I have to pay him $20 because he has 1 smokestack on his space. So that's his profit.
Okay, so we got $10 and $10. This is money I put in the bank.
Yes.
So okay. You put money in the bank. You lost a smokestack and had to pay money.
Yes. So that means that I'm now not able to pollute as much as I was because I lost the smokestack. So I won't get paid profit for that if someone lands on my spot.
So cap and trade is basically what it comes down to is everybody's given permission to produce a certain amount of pollution. based on what they're already producing or what they should already be producing, more or less.
Everybody who?
Industries, the biggest polluting industries. So that includes power plants, oil refineries, cement producers, which is a particularly carbon-intensive activity, but also smaller polluters such as big universities have collectively a large footprint. Some of them have their own power plants, for example, and other types of manufacturers.
So carbon emission on that scale.
Right.
We're not talking about me and you and, you know, my home or my car.
Right. So cap and trade is aimed at addressing most of California's emissions. The idea is to try to bring that into the existing economic system, which the proponents of cap and trade feel is the most effective and efficient way of regulating carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases. It's an unproven theory because nobody has ever tried this before, at least on this scale. There are experiments in Europe, in Canada, in the Northeast corridor of the United States, none of which have really taken off the ground and become really successful markets, in part because the legislation is so complex and there are so many different ways to cheat the system and there are so many ambiguities, but also because none of those systems is large enough to create a global marketplace to address the global need.
All right, so I rolled a 4. And I landed on this summer auction spot, one of 4 spaces on the board that represents the quarterly auctions that go into the cap and trade system. I can offer up smokestacks for sale, or I can buy them from other players who are offering them for sale. And if I want to make some money, if I'm going low on money, I can offer to sell my smokestacks and get some money so I can reinvest that in offsets or research and development light bulbs. Or if I want to buy smokestacks, I can offer a price for them to other players and then place them on my factory spaces. And that would increase the chances of me getting more profit if a player lands on one in the future.
But you only have like $20 left, like 30.
Yeah, so I'm doing much better than Anna is.
Mm-hmm.
And she has some tough decisions to make about how much she's going to pollute in the short term. And I don't know what she's going to decide.
What you going to do, Anna?
Okay, I don't have that much money, so I'm going to offer up some of my smokestacks for sale.
Okay, so she's liquidating her productive facilities. So
are you buying?
Well, now that I've got her over a barrel, I'm going to hike up the price.
Ooh!
This is the monopoly aspect to it. I'm going to say, I'll sell one smokestack for $20.
This is pretty much how it works in the real world?
Pretty much. You know, it doesn't go from one facility to the other facility typically.
Just a central market.
Yeah, it goes into a big computer program, and the highest price at auction is the going price. And when people make a commitment to buy or sell certain numbers of tons of carbon dioxide or the equivalent, they have to pay or buy that much.
Who do you think should play this game? Who are your dream people that, you know, you wish would play your game?
I wish that teenagers who are just trying to figure out how capitalism and the economy works, who are going to be the decision makers way into the future when climate change really starts to take effect, are going to incorporate this into their psyche and really get an intuitive sense of how important the environment is, how important it is to include things like carbon dioxide into the economic calculus and not just consider them externalities. You know, you put it out the smokestack and it disappears. It doesn't disappear, and the economy has to eventually reflect that.
Michael Stoll is executive director of the San Francisco Public Press, and Anna Vignier is a reporter and illustrator there. We'll have a link to the board game California Cap and Trade, which is part of the Public Press's summer edition, at KALW.org. And Before we leave you today, we want to share the story behind the audiograph sound we've been playing all week on KALW.
Trini Whitaker, ladies and gentlemen!
We asked what you think it is and where in the Bay Area it's from. We sent KALW's Stephen Short out for the answer.
When people around the world think of San Francisco, they think of that big orange bridge and those little cable cars with the distinctive sound of their bells.
Remember what it is? Does that ring a bell? Rice-a-roni.
The San Francisco tree.
It's hard to imagine now, but in the late 1940s, plans were underway to eliminate this old-fashioned form of transit. Several of the tracks were actually removed before a coalition of women's civic organizations came together to push a referendum to the city charter. Their motto, "The color and romance of San Francisco must not be destroyed." Voters overwhelmingly approved the idea of keeping the cars, and a couple of years later, this would be 1949, a contest began to find the best bell ringer among the gripmen. You know, the folks who grip the brake to control the speed of the cars. Each gripman has a personal style, a sound all his own.
My name is Leonard Oates, and I'm a three-time bell ringing champ in San Francisco on the cable car.
Oates won the prize in 2007, 8, and 9. What's his championship secret?
Practice. That's the biggest secret, practice. You got to practice all the time. Everybody say, oh, you play at home because I have my own bell at home. No, I play on the cable car because you want to get the reaction to the people when you're playing. And if they like that, okay, they like that. That's what I'm going to add in my contest.
While this is clearly a competition about sound, one of the judges says there's more to it than listening. Kim Huff is senior marketing manager for Ghirardelli Chocolate Company. This is her third year as a judge. She looks and listens to the contestants.
Yes, because, you know, the ones that really get into it and have the rhythm and put on a little performance, those are the ones that really get the crowds going, and that really matters a lot. It's really important.
Some contestants wear white gloves to stand out. Others add to the show by trading back and forth from their left to right hand. Judges also note rhythm and originality, because a cable car bell only has one tone. But the essential part is playing the bell. Pull the cord to the left or right, pull it gently or vigorously, it all changes the sound. And it appears the competition is about to begin. Here's Debbie Durst, MC for the event.
Welcome to the 50th annual SFMTA Cable Car Bell Ringing Competition.
Seven contestants are in the running today. Our man Oates is in the middle of the pack.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Leonard Oates.
This is an important match for Oates because last year he lost in overtime.
Yes, I did. I lost to a guy that I taught. And he wanted some secrets, and I gave it to him, and I didn't actually think he would beat me, and he did.
Leonard Oates, ladies and gentlemen.
The final contestant today is the defending champion, that student who Oates taught last year.
He's been with the cable cars for 10 years. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Trini Whitaker. Trini Whitaker, ladies and gentlemen.
Once the judges decide, the rankings are announced in reverse order. First, the amateur ringers, whose cash prizes go to nonprofits, then third place, then second, and then Debbie Durst announces the winner.
The 2013 World Champion Bell Ringer is Mr. Trini Whitaker. Trini Whitaker, ladies and gentlemen. Your 2013 Cable Car Bell Ringing Champion. Thank you so much for coming out and helping to support this great San Francisco tradition. I've been Debbie Durst. I'll see you again next year. Go Giants!
In addition to the accolades and the trophy, Whitaker also takes home $500, along with other prizes. As for Whitaker's instructor, the visibly disappointed Leonard Oates declined to speak to the media. In San Francisco's Union Square, I'm Stephen Short for Audiograph.
Aw, poor Leonard. Well, he didn't win this time, but one of you did. Congratulations to Sandy Kepler. We'll be sending you a KALW t-shirt. For the rest of you, there'll be another contest next week. In the meantime, visit our Facebook page to hear more from Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. That does it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Laura Flynn, Nina Gensler-Debs, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Holly J. McDee, Daniel Moore, Stephen Short, and Brooke Welty. And a special thank you to our summer interns from Burton High School, Marco Choi, Megan Quintana, Christian Rose, and Ben Vu, who've been spending each weekday in their summer inside our newsroom.
Thank you!
Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. The music you're hearing is by the bilingual San Francisco band Macru. Martina Castro, whose name you just heard in our crew credits, is their lead singer. You can listen for what Macru calls a unifying positive vibe in their songs when they play the Surf Spot in Pacifica on Sunday. It's an afternoon show and it starts at 2 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.